Good evening. Good evening and welcome again to another evening at the Vancouver Institute. It's a great pleasure to see so many regular members of the Vancouver Institute here tonight, but also a number of new faces. My name is Cheryl Grace, and it's my pleasure to be the president of the Vancouver Institute this year. And I want to, for those of you who are new, for those of you who are familiar with this little spiel, you can just forget it for the moment. But for those of you who are new, I do want to point out to you that we have a wonderful program with the Vancouver Institute. And the cost of membership is one of the greatest bargains going for a season of superb lectures from a wide range of people across the country and internationally, and even on occasion people from UBC, as is the case tonight. So if you haven't already picked up a membership, please do so. You'll find a schedule of speakers listed, and the next speaker will be Dr. John MacDonald, co-founder of MacDonald Detweiler, and that will be next Saturday night. And I have a couple of announcements. One is that we have an additional lecture this spring. It will be on April the 10th, that is the week after Easter, and it is co-sponsored with the Vancouver Institute by UBC's Tsing Tao School of Journalism. You saw Mr. James Fallow's name up on the overhead as you were coming into the room. And Mr. Fallows is the former editor of the very distinguished and long-lived magazine, The Atlantic Monthly. And his most recent book is Breaking the News. I have a title this evening, which I haven't had on other evenings. So listen to this one. His title is going to be After Monica, Can the Media Be Saved? The Jane Coop Chopin Concert is now really closed. We've managed to have all the tickets spoken for, and I'm sorry that that's the case. If by any chance there are any members of the Vancouver Institute who do not intend to use their tickets, please return them, because there are still a lot of people who would like to come if there were tickets available to do so. Now I would like to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Clyde Hertzman, currently the director of the program in population health in the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, joined UBC in 1985 as the head of the Division of Occupational and Environmental Health in the Department of Healthcare and Epidemiology. He has been, over the years, very active as medical doctor and certainly as a professor in the Faculty of Medicine. He has published over 250, by my count at least, Clyde, 250 co-authored articles and chapters in books, and indeed one of these chapters is contained in the book which you saw on your way into the hall this evening. The book is called Why Are Some People Healthier and Others Not? In addition to these many articles and chapters and books, he has published three books himself. Dr. Hertzman's research interests include health policy in an aging society, environmental risk assessment, early child development and health, an area in which he has played a major role in developing the conceptual framework for the determinants of health, and the wider issues of health across the human life cycle. In his lecture for us this evening, Dr. Hertzman will address some of these wider issues. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Clyde Hertzman.
Not easy to get this thing on.
Ah, there it's on. For those of you who read the brochure, you will have seen that the title for tonight's talk is Why Are Some Societies Healthy and Others Not? The title of the book that Cheryl just mentioned was I suppose, ambitious enough, and the idea of trying to scale up from the level of why are some people healthy and others not to the level of why are some societies healthy and others not is probably ludicrously ambitious. And if you're expecting to come away from tonight with a succinct answer to that, you're going to be disappointed. However, I am prepared, based on the work that people in the Population Health and Human Development programs in the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research have been doing over the last 10 or 12 years, to give you a number of insights that we have organized over time that really do help to understand some of this question, and I think set us up for further understandings in the future. For those of you who have long memories, you may have heard Bob Evans or Fraser Mustard speak here a few years ago. And so what you're going to hear tonight will build on the kind of things they had to say. I just talked to Bob before this presentation. I realized the last time he presented was in 1996, so presumably you'd have to have a pretty long memory to remember most of it. In any event, what I want to do is go straight at the issue of the health or ill health of societies through two principal approaches. The first is kind of a methodological issue, which has got to do with the idea of working backwards from systematic differences that we see in the healthfulness of societies and asking the question, why do those differences exist? Usually speaking, in epidemiology or public health, what we do is we identify some sort of a risk factor and work forwards to ask the question, what is its impact on health? But in this situation, what we're doing is starting with systematic differences in health status between different countries and working backwards to say, what are the determinants of those differences? At Harvard, there is a biologist by the name of Richard Levins who has worked mostly in the area of ecology and recently has got interested in population health. And he put forward a couple of principles which merge very well with the work that we have done over the last while in human populations. And so I'm going to put these forward as a basis for thinking about how to think about differences in the health status of populations. What he told me was, you know, you epidemiologists are always worrying about the question of average differences between people. But if you consider that people are organisms like other organisms in society, in the world, that what you notice is that when, let's say, corn is grown at the right temperature, what will tend to happen is that the corn will all grow more, corn will more or less all grow to about the same height. However, if what you do is you grow it under conditions which are, say, too hot or too cold, in other words, the ecological niche into which you put it is moderately hostile, what you will see not only is that the average height of the corn will fall, but in fact the level of variation in the height of the corn will increase as well. And for some reason or another, you epidemiologists only concern yourself with averages and not with variations. Well, Richard was perceptive in a certain way, but the fact is that for the last little while, we have been very, very interested in a number of factors in relation to human populations which are quite analogous to what he has to say about ecosystems in general. And by and large, what we've been interested in, it is true, is the question of average health statuses in populations, but we've also been interested in the level of variation between populations as well. And so when we consider the question of what are the determinants of healthy societies, what we are interested in primarily is this little low-tech diagram here. This is going to be the only slide you're going to see tonight, is this one silly little diagram here. And what it suggests here is that if we think about countries, we can think in terms of their health status using any kind of simple nominal variable, such as life expectancy, for instance. And we can consider that life expectancy as a measure of health status can be longer or shorter, in other words, better or worse, in different countries. And what we're interested in doing is identifying those factors such that when you plot each country out on a graph like that as a single dot in terms of its life expectancy, that what you will see is a pattern where as you go along the putative determinant of health, the average health status will decline and the variation will increase. And the inference there would be then that this condition of this determinant of health, which obtains up here, is the way we would want it. In other words, this is the appropriate ecological niche for a human population. And as we move in this direction, we're moving towards ecological conditions which are increasingly hostile. And so the name of the game, in terms of trying to understand what makes some societies healthier than others, is first off to be able to identify what factor or factors goes along this axis here such that it creates that kind of opening pattern here, which we call a fan open pattern. And then secondly, asking ourselves, what are the factors that create the spread at this end? In other words, those societies that operate down here, which are at the hostile end of this determinant of health, but nonetheless have relatively good health status, are displaying some factors of resiliency that we would be interested in. So in a sense, to simplify this question of what makes some societies healthier than others, we're interested first off in defining what opens the fan, and second of all, what makes some countries at the hostile end of the determinant healthier than others. Now, the first cut of this kind of thing, if we look internationally and we put all of the countries in the world on it, is to simply look at life expectancy against a measure of income, like GDP per person. And if you do that, in fact, this is precisely the pattern that you get, such that up at this end of the curve, we have a group of about 30 countries with gross domestic products of about 15,000 US per person or higher. Okay, and Canada is among those countries. Those might be considered the wealthy countries. And amongst them, the average life expectancy varies over a range of between about 74 years, when you average men and women together, up to about 79 years. Next after, there are a group of middle-income countries. Middle-income countries can be defined arbitrarily, but let's say they run from about 2 to about 12, 13,000 US per person in terms of income. And in that range, the average life expectancy runs from about 60 years up to about 75 years. And then finally, there are the poor countries with the lowest incomes. And amongst that group of countries, the variation is even wider. And there, life expectancy runs from a low of about 43 years to a high of about 73 years. So up at the top end, the variation is about 5 years, about 15 years, and then about 30 years down at this end. Now, I'd like to be able to tell you that you can go from that observation to some sort of a holistic theory of everything that explains what's going on there in this situation. But it doesn't work that way. What we have is a series of insights which have come from a variety of different research projects that allow us to essentially look at those three groups separately and go into some detail about what is going on, what makes some wealthy countries healthier than others, what makes some middle-income countries healthier than others, and what makes some poor countries healthier than others, and then try to reconstruct afterwards what the ultimate message might be. And I'm going to start with the rich countries, partly because our group has really spent a lot more time studying and understanding the rich countries, and we basically have the most fine-grained understanding of what's going on there. So here, once again, we're talking about a family of approximately 30 countries that are the wealthiest countries in the world. And they have a life expectancy difference amongst them of about 5 years. 5 years doesn't sound like a lot when you can compare it to middle or low-income countries, but it still does represent an approximate doubling of age-specific mortality during the period from age 25 to 75 in order to generate a 5-year difference in life expectancy. So it is significant so far as that goes, and it is worthy of comment. And so what we would want to do then is focus on those countries and ask ourselves, if you just look at those group of 30-odd countries, what would allow us to see this fan opening pattern amongst those countries? What I'd like to do first is tell you a few things that doesn't do it. That first off, differences in income among those countries does not produce the fan open pattern. Nor does differences in level of economic growth amongst them. Thirdly, differences in the level of healthcare spending does not form the fan open pattern. And finally, differences in lifestyle factors such as the level of cigarette smoking or, for that matter, diet doesn't really do it either. What does do it, it turns out, is taking each country and dividing the population up by some nominal measure of socioeconomic status. So, well, I won't be able to get rid of that. I'll just cross it out and just put here socioeconomic status. So we can divide these populations up by level of income within the country, by level of education, or by the status and prestige of the occupations that individuals have. And it doesn't much matter which way you do it. What ends up happening is that within each of these countries, what you end up seeing is a gradient in health status. In other words, a monotonic decline in health status when you go from the highest level of the nominal socioeconomic status measure to the lowest. So if you say take Canadian society and you divide it up into quintiles of income, those who are in the top quintile of income are healthier than those who are in the second quintile of income, who are healthier than those who are in the middle quintile, who are healthier than those who are in the fourth, who are healthier than those in the fifth. So it goes in a monotonic pattern. And that is true for each of the countries, the major, the wealthy countries of the world. But what is also true is that if you lay these 30-odd curves from each of the countries out on a graph like this, you will get this fan open pattern. In other words, some countries have a flatter gradient than others. In other words, in some of the wealthy countries, there is greater socioeconomic inequality in health status than others. And the countries that have greater socioeconomic inequality, on average, have lower health status. And those that have less socioeconomic inequality in health status tend to have higher health status. Now that raises some very, very interesting questions about why that should be so. And so we have spent a lot of time in the last 10 years in the Population Health Program and the Human Development Program in the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research trying to understand the character of these gradients, what produces them. And there are a few factors which are very, very important in relation to them. The first thing is that they tend to cut across virtually all of the major disease processes in society. There are a few notable exceptions, such as malignant melanoma, which is the nasty kind of skin cancer, or cancer of the uterus. But most of the other major causes of disease and death show a socioeconomic gradient. Moreover, the gradient has shown the ability to replicate itself on new conditions as they emerge in society. So that if you go back to the turn of the century, you will see a gradient in relation to major infectious disease causes of disease and death, such as tuberculosis. And then gradually, as tuberculosis became less and less important, and heart disease became epidemic in society. It's true that it entered our society originally as a disease of the affluent, but within 20 or 30 years, it settled into a socioeconomic gradient pattern. And in fact, over the last 20 years, AIDS is in the process of doing exactly the same thing. So the gradient not only can cut across a wide range of disease processes, but it has the capacity to replicate itself on new disease processes as it comes along. So in order to understand the gradient, this is one of the most important insights that we've had, you have to think at a level below and beyond disease-specific pathology. In other words, you have to think about factors that, in a very, very broad way, code for vitality, resilience, or vulnerability to disease, and the way in which wealthy societies, somehow or another, produce systematic socioeconomic differences in vitality or resilience on the one hand versus vulnerability on the other. Now, we've done a number of empirical investigations of this, and we can rule out some things. We can rule out reverse causation, and we can rule out a form of differential social mobility such that those who are less healthy are more downwardly mobile than those who are destined to be more healthy over time. Those are not the explanations. Similarly, differential access to healthcare services, although it explains part of the gradient, only explains a small portion of it, and differential behavioral and lifestyle factors, once again, only explains a small fraction of the gradient. The majority of this gradient must be attributed one way or another to social circumstances per se. Now, the question is how? How does that come about? And when we ask that question, we're really at the frontier of some very interesting multidisciplinary research that's going on now. Because we do understand, to a certain extent, that there must be some kind of a process whereby differential social circumstances, beginning early in life and unfolding throughout the life course, must be able to embed itself in human biology such that you get systematic differences in resistance to or vulnerability to whatever the current diseases are of a given era. The empirical evidence is pretty clear that that is true, and we have some clues as to how that might be taking place. But they're only clues right now. And so we've been putting together teams, basically, of neurobiologists, people interested in the connection between the brain and the immune, the brain and hormone mechanisms, primatologists who are interested in studying these factors in primate species of one sort or another, epidemiologists who are doing longitudinal studies starting at birth and going to mid-age and starting at mid-age and going to late in life, so that we can, one way or another, sort out how it is that socioeconomic gradients in health status emerge from some sort of lifelong interaction between differential social circumstances and the developing organism. And if I had a lot more time, I could give you more insights into that, but I don't have a lot more time, so I'm just going to move on and ask you to take my word for it that this is an important area of research right now. So anyway, what we notice, though, among the wealthy countries is that the gradient is steeper in some countries and shallower in others, and that seems to be the thing that makes the difference in the level of health between wealthy countries. And we do understand some of the things which cause some wealthy societies to have flatter socioeconomic gradients in health status than others. And there are four basic characteristics which I'd like to mention to you. And as I'm mentioning these to you, I think you can see what some of the potential social policy implications are of them. The first one is income distribution. That is to say that the countries that tend to have the flatter socioeconomic gradients in health status tend to be ones which have relatively equitable income distributions. In other words, the rich aren't so much richer than the poor. So a country like the United States, where one citizen, Bill Gates, literally does have as much wealth as the 40% of the poorest people in the country, tends to fall on this kind of line. Whereas countries like Japan, which tend to have small income differentials, even from the top or bottom of corporations, or countries like Sweden, which have quite energetic redistribution programs, tend to have smaller socioeconomic gradients in health status, and higher average health status. The second characteristic of the relatively healthy countries is that one way or another, either through social policy or through cultural tradition, there are forms of collective responsibility taken for the experiences of very young children in the vulnerable ages from 0 to, say, 5 years old. In other words, when we look across the world at, for instance, child poverty rates, Canada, the United States, and Australia allow fairly high rates of child poverty and tolerate those sort of things, whereas in Western Europe and Japan, for instance, the rates of child poverty are much lower. Similarly, a lot more is done to make sure that children do not grow up in isolation and do not, when they encounter formal care, do not encounter indifferent qualities of formal care. So that in those early periods, when a great deal of the sculpting of the brain is going on and a great deal of the development of basic competence and coping skills is going on, those societies tend to recognize a collective responsibility and act on it. Third is a corollary of the second in a certain way, these societies tend to be ones that have a philosophy of not leaving children in the school age behind. In other words, the emphasis is not simply on promoting genius among the elite, but it is not allowing, in a sense, an underclass of semi-literate, semi-numerate people to emerge. And so, for instance, if you look at the international literacy study that the OECD did a few years ago, and you compare young adults in Canada with less than high school graduation to young adults in Sweden with less than high school graduation, what you will see is that in Canada, approximately 70% of those with less than high school graduation are operating at the lowest level of literacy and numeracy on a 4-point scale constructed by the OECD. Whereas in Sweden, the similarly lowest educated group, only about 20% are operating at the lowest level. So a philosophy of not leaving children behind. Similarly, when we ask why is it that on average Japan does very, very well on international math tests, it's not particularly because the kids at the top end of the scale are doing so much better. It's because the kids at the bottom end of the scale are doing so much better. And finally, the fourth characteristic is that in the adult period, the healthiest countries, once again, tend, either through cultural tradition or through social policy, to put in place a number of innovations which buffer both the material and the psychosocial stress of the working population, which must also provide the majority of child care and elder care as well. And that tends to be either labor market policies or maybe housing policies or policies that reinforce the stability of neighborhoods, for instance, or in the case of Canada, our Medicare system, which is the factor which seems to have become the dominant measure of Canadian identity. And it's just as a segue, you may or may not be aware that the ECO studies done for the government consistently show that, in fact, when you ask Canadians what is the factor which is most likely to keep the country together, the answer is Medicare. We can maybe even think that Canada might be an old Indian word for the people who take care of each other when they're sick, or at least pay for somebody else to do so. Anyway, the point is that in adult life, some of the Western, the wealthy societies have in place a network of mechanisms that reduce the demands on the individual to try to control life circumstances which are fundamentally beyond their control. And those societies which have organized either through social or policy or cultural methods to provide those buffers are on average healthier than the others. So those are the wealthy countries. Now what of the middle income countries? And here there are a number of different ways to look at this. But the most interesting by far has been something that's occurred historically. And that is the political change which took place in Central and Eastern Europe starting in 1989. As you're aware, for about 40 years after World War II, the Soviet bloc existed in Central and Eastern Europe. And then starting in 1989, first with Poland, and then rapidly throughout the region, there was a rapid political change. And within a couple of years, the Soviet-style systems were pushed aside in all the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, which are a chunk. They're not all of the middle-income countries of the world, but are certainly a chunk of them. And what happened during that period of time was is that there was an abrupt decline in the level of economic output in those countries, 15% to 30%, as well as quite a lot of evidence of social disruption as well. However, within a couple of years, the fan open pattern that I've indicated here had started to emerge among these countries. So if instead of thinking of the factor that opens the fan here as being GDP per person or socioeconomic status, now, in a sense, what we're talking about here is historical time. So that by 1991, 2, 3, 4, through to the mid-90s, what was starting to happen is that some of the countries, and the Czech Republic is the best example of that, had had a little blip down in its health status and then was carrying on. And other countries, and Russia is probably the best example of this, had a little blip down in its health status and then just kept falling. So that by the mid-1990s, the Czech Republic's health status was starting to head back up towards the health status of Western countries, whereas in the Russia and the Ukraine and Belarus, countries like that, average life expectancy had dropped 5 or 6 years, which is an enormously devastating effect, which is almost impossible to create even during war. And so, once again, we see across that region this fan open pattern, and it behooves us to ask questions about what it was that made those kind of differences. Well, one thing that it could be is pollution. And in fact, one of the jobs that I did in the last 10 years was spend the best part, actually, of 4 years running around to 10 different countries in Eastern Europe looking at environmental pollution and trying to estimate its impact on health status. And indeed, Central and Eastern Europe, there, the legacy of the Soviet period was a lot of environmental pollution of public health significance. Dust, sulfur dioxide, lead, a variety of other chemicals of one sort or another in air primarily, but also problems with soil and problems with water. However, when you look at the effect of environmental pollution, the effects tended to be localized, and yet the health status effects tended to be generalized over a much broader area. So pollution is not the primary explanation. Another thing that we heard about a lot was the question of the healthcare systems collapsing in Central and Eastern Europe. And certainly, you do see an effect of increases in levels of medically avoidable death. However, when you ask the question, what are the conditions which have driven the decline in life expectancy in a place like Russia? It tends to be increased incidence of heart disease and increased incidence of violent and external, if you like, accidental causes of death. In other words, things that are driven by the fact of the event, not by the treatment of the event afterwards. So although medical care, the collapse of medical care systems plays a role, once again, it is not the major role. Similarly, there's been a lot of concern about the smoking and the drinking patterns in Central and Eastern Europe, and it's certainly true that control of personal habits and behaviors is an issue in the area. But take my word for it, when you look at the epidemiology of the situation, in particular, when you see how similar the experience of men and women is in the region, and how different the experience of men and women is in terms of these particular health habits, it is pretty clear from the standpoint of basic epidemiologic sense that the question of lifestyle habits and behaviors does not explain the differences so much. Now, what has happened, though? If we say compare Russia with the Czech Republic, a number of things have happened. Before 1989, One of the true accomplishments of socialism, as it was practiced in Central and Eastern Europe, was, in fact, to create a relatively equitable distribution of income. However, after the end of the Soviet era, some societies, and the Czech Republic is an example of one, have managed to actually maintain that to a certain extent. However, in Russia has gone, in less than 10 years, from a society with one of the most equitable income distributions in the world to one of the most inequitable distributions in the world. So one of the factors was a massive shift between a country like the Czech Republic that was able to basically maintain some of those advantages and a place like Russia, which turned into, on the one hand, a society of the semi-destitute, and on the other hand, a society of the robber barons. So one thing. Second thing is, we can plot out the socioeconomic gradients within these countries in terms of health status. And what you see is that within the Czech Republic, since 1989, there has been a slight steepening of the socioeconomic gradient in health status, but it's very, very slight. Whereas in Russia, it is very, very great indeed. In fact, the steepness of the socioeconomic gradient in health status, it's basically been a doubling of the gradient. So a very, very large difference indeed. We've done a number of other direct surveys in Russia and the Czech Republic and other countries in the region. And there are a number of other clues to what's going on here. One of the things is that when you ask Russians, for instance, about material deprivation, you find a very, very wide range of material deprivation. So simply access to food, shelter, and heat has become a problem there. And so at one end of the socioeconomic distribution, you have people who are scratching for basic survival. And when you look at the health status of the population, just using simple measures of self-reported health, what you see is that the level of material deprivation that people are under is an incredibly powerful determinant of people's perception of their own health status. And it turns out that perception of one's own health status is a very, very good marker for subsequent mortality and disability. Similarly, you see enormous differences in the level of sense of life control within a society like Russia compared to a society like the Czech Republic. And then finally, what you see when you ask questions about attitudes towards the institutions of society, in a country like the Czech Republic, you will tend to see something that is pretty similar to Canada. In other words, a fairly high level of civic affiliation, of trust for the institutions that people have to rely on in a day-to-day way. Whereas in Russia, what you see is a very, very sharp division of society into three different groups. One group are the group who trust the entrepreneurs and the new business environment in Russia, and have virtually no trust for the traditional institutions of Russian society, the police, the army, the press, the parliament, and so forth. The next group is the group that has trust for the traditional institutions in Russian society, but virtually none for the new entrepreneurial ones. And the third group is the group that trusts the church, and neither of the other two groups. And it's a very, very, very stark contrast. And it turns out that those who trust the new institutions of Russian society are much healthier than those who trust the traditional institutions or those who trust the religious institutions. Now, that is by no means a full picture of what's going on. But the suggestion here is that when you ask what is the resiliency factor that exists in a place like the Czech Republic that does not exist in a place like Russia, it seems to be that during a time of political instability and political transition, the Czech society has some elements of civil society to fall back on. And when we ask where it comes from, well, presumably we're asking some questions which deal with long-term historical differences. And in fact, it turns out that if you take the region of Central and Eastern Europe, and you divide it up into those countries which were part, once upon a time, of the Austro-Hungarian or the Prussian empires, those countries that were part of the Ottoman Empire, and those countries that were part of Tsarist Russia. That health status, the health status response to the end of the Soviet era, basically goes highest in the countries that were once part of the Austro-Hungarian or Prussian empires, intermediate, those that were part of the Ottoman Empire, and lowest, those that were part of the Tsarist Empire in the past. And that leaves some very, very interesting questions about what might be going on there. I have no idea, really, how to answer what the actual underlying constructs are, but one or two of the insights that we do have about this sort of thing come from work that has been done in Italy by a fellow by the name of Robert Putnam, who's looked at the profound social differences between northern and southern Italy and has done work on long-term historic trends in the development of civic community and how societies that have a long-term historical substrate of trading and freeholding tend to encourage over time more horizontal networks of trust and affiliation, whereas societies that tend to be based on clan or plantation style economies tend to have more vertical affiliations, and it tends to be those societies which have horizontal affiliations that can weather crises better. And in fact, when you take that model and you apply it to other parts of the world, it has some very, very interesting implications. For instance, it helps to explain the north-south differences in health status in the United States. But anyway, that's about as far as I can go on the insights from the middle-income countries. Finally, we come to the poor countries. Now, as I mentioned before, the level of variation in health status amongst the poor countries is very, very large. So you have some countries, many of them in sub-Saharan Africa, where the average life expectancy runs in 43, 45, 47 years, something like that. And yet, on the other hand, there are a small number of very poor countries, and the usual examples that people give are Costa Rica and the Kerala province of India, which have life expectancies in excess of 70 years. In other words, life expectancies which are not far off our own. And that fact in and of itself does point out the fact that reasonably good health is consistent one way or another with relative poverty in the world scale. The question is, though, what is the difference? What makes for this 30-year difference between one and the other? Well, the first thing that we understand is that the difference between the health status of the healthiest of the poor countries and the least healthy of the poor countries is driven primarily by infant and child health. In other words, things like infant mortality or mortality before the age of 5 varies enormously among these countries. And the healthy countries among the poor countries have been those that have managed to reduce infant and child mortality nearly to the level that we experience here in Canada. Whereas the countries that have not done very well with that tend to be the ones that are less healthy effectively. Well, if it reduces to that, it turns out that in developing countries, there are a relatively small number of relatively well-understood things that you need to do in order to protect, if you'd like, the maternal child unit and to reduce infant and child mortality and morbidity. And they involve simple things to do with oral rehydration, with the use of toilet seats even on privies so that you reduce hand-to-mouth transmission of disease, or so-called fecal-oral transmission, issues of child spacing, maintenance of breastfeeding for as long as possible, and avoidance of such things as indoor open fires. And what seems to be, though, and these are all pretty low-tech things, they're not particularly mysterious at all, but what seems to be different between different poor countries is the basic absorptive capacity to learn and practice these basic lessons at the domestic level. And the overarching factor that seems to apply here has got to do simply with the level of education and independence of women. That in those societies, and Kerala province is the best example of this, have had long traditions of high levels of education and independence of women, so that the women serving as mothers, in this case, are able to absorb the lessons and to practice them in an environment where they can control some resources and make some decisions. And in those societies where women, by and large, are kept ignorant, uneducated, and isolated, the lessons tend to not get through, and so are not practiced to the same degree. And so, for instance, within a country like Pakistan, you can see, for instance, in the areas where the Ismaili community tends to have a dominant influence, infant mortality rate running at about 22 per thousand, which is not so bad if you think about it, whereas in the rest of the country, infant mortality runs at closer to 100 per thousand. Similarly, in a country like Costa Rica, the wonderful example there was that back in 1947, for reasons that I'm not quite certain of, they decided to abolish their armed forces and to concentrate all of their rather slender resources on health, education, and social services. And so, over the last little while, they've managed to create a fairly high level of literacy and a fairly egalitarian structure, which has led to the transmission of these lessons as well. Now, that is a very brief, and I admit, a very glib walk through the nations of the world. Those of you who have traveled will know that there's enormous amounts of diversity and enormous detail that is left out by this kind of description. But I would suggest to you at the same time, across the rich, the middle income, and the poor countries, that if you sit back and think about some of the stories I've told you, you can probably piece together on your own. But primarily what they've got to do with is the issue of the way in which forms of social infrastructure are fundamental to the maintenance of good health in the world. And on the one hand, for those who spend a lot of time, like we do in our society, worrying about the delivery of health care services, which in many ways are like the icing on the cake when it comes to the question of what maintains good health in our society. These might sound very counterintuitive and difficult to accept. And yet, we live in a world now where there are large constraints in many ways on allowing poor countries to imitate rich countries in terms, for instance, of consumption of photosynthetic resources. Many of you may be aware of the notion of the ecological footprint, i.e. the notion that there is only a finite amount of photosynthetic energy that can be absorbed by the world in any given year. And therefore, in principle, there's only a finite amount of that energy that can be consumed by the human population in the world in the form of food, energy, etc., etc. And as it stands right now, the amount of consumption of photosynthetic resources by the wealthy countries in the world is much greater than would be sustainable if all of the countries of the world were to try to live the way that we live. So in order, theoretically, for us to be able to bring up the health status of the entire world, we have to find ways to be able to substitute social infrastructure for the infrastructure of mass consumption, one way or another. And so some of these lessons in terms of what makes some countries resilient and some of the lessons that we can learn in terms of the way in which social infrastructure can make some countries resilient and can improve their health status without necessarily going the consumption route that we have gone, end up becoming hopeful lessons for the 21st century. And with that, I'll stop. Okay. Okay.
The floor is open now for questions, so please begin.
Yes.
I'd like to ask you, please, to elaborate on what you were saying about what we could do in Canada changing social infrastructure.
Okay. The question was, what should the federal government and what should the provincial governments be doing to improve social infrastructure in Canada? It's a very large question. I can throw out a number of ideas. I think the way I was spinning the discussion suggested to you, first off, I think we do need to take much more seriously the question of collective responsibility in the early period, in the 0 to 5 period. We do, so far in this country, very little to ensure that young children, when they're growing up, have optimum environments, such that by kindergarten age, we already see large socioeconomic differences in the level of cognitive and behavioral readiness to learn among Canadian children. And these play themselves out in terms of school success and social mobility and health status later on. So there's a whole area there that can be built upon. Second, we've tended over time to play rather fast and loose with a number of policies that other countries have held more sacred. For instance, if you think about housing policies, Canada's really varied quite a bit over time in its willingness to mix market and non-market housing in a variety of different ways. And if you look, for instance, at a place like Vancouver, you have a whole series of issues that come together around that. And they range from, on the one hand, homelessness, on the other hand, how we handle people with mental health problems, on another hand, how we handle people who need alternate modified forms of living arrangements in order to stay out of hospital. And finally, dealing with issues of creating and maintaining mixed neighborhoods so that we don't get increasing ghettoization, socioeconomic ghettoization, which is a real problem for children's development. So we have good reason, for instance, to go back and ask ourselves some very profound questions about why it is we've abandoned the idea of having some form of social policies around housing in that regard. Another example would be, for instance, thinking about the way in which the unemployment insurance discussion went over time. The reduction in the benefits and the argument about whether the benefits should be restored or if you should reduce the payroll deductions or what we should do with that has taken place really without any discussion about the potential effect that having that kind of redistributive mechanism might have had on health and well-being over time. And there is some research now that's going on that's going to be able to comment on that, but I think it's a shame that we allow those kind of things to take place without considering that we do know that, in fact, those kind of programs can potentially be important for maintaining a level of health and well-being within the population. And so that's something else that we need to consider. And I think what I'm saying there is that there are a number of social policy issues like that that come and go where the issue of how health status relates to them is underrepresented, right? And I mean, that's one example, but there are others. I think maybe that's enough on that question.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes. Sorry, go ahead. The question was, is Parkinson's disease a disease rooted in the blood, did you say? To be honest with you, I'm not sure that I feel comfortable answering a question like that directly. I think when you start looking at conditions on a condition-by-condition basis, you know, there's each health condition that there is out there has its own complex set of determinants, if you'd like. And I guess I'm not that comfortable to, you know, have a kind of a discussion about an individual question there. It's a little bit like sort of practicing medicine out in the open. So perhaps I could talk to you about that afterwards, if you don't mind. Yes. Yes.
Do you relate the life expectancy and the quality of housing over time? Because the kind of social policies you speak of were in place 40 years ago.
Yes.
When the life expectancy of Canadians was less than it is today.
Yeah, well, the question is, though, I mean, let's say, for instance, you take something that I suppose you had something to do with, that whole area around Falls Creek, the south side of Falls Creek. What you'd be really interested to know is whether or not, if you impaneled a cohort of people who were born and grew up there and compared them to a socioeconomically matched cohort of individuals from other communities that didn't have the kind of characteristics that they had there, whether or not there would be differences in level of health status as the years went on, right? That would be the kind of thing that I would be interested in knowing, to be able to evaluate that sort of thing, right? What interests me is that when you guys had that ministry of whatever it was, housing and urban development once upon a time, and were doing things like that, it seemed a good idea at the time, and yet one way or another, it fell out of fashion. And we don't see developments like that anymore. And at the same time, we see a lot of danger signals in the way things are going in the urban environments that would suggest that those things are ought to be worthwhile. And so I guess I regret the fact that back 30 or 40 years ago, we have not put in place population cohorts so that we could assess in a clear way what the effect of those kind of things were. Now, the reason that I say that sort of thing is, you know, for instance, and this is part of where we get information on the value of things that take place in early childhood. There have been, for instance, long-term follow-up studies of cohorts of children who were part of Head Start programs in the States during the late 1960s. And there you can see, for instance, the effect of a damn good daycare program supplemented by weekly visits to the home to help improve parenting skills for a year and a half between age 3 and 4 and a half has effects on health, well-being, and competence at age 27, irrespective of anything going on in the 24-year period in between, right? And that's what the kind of thing that we need to know more about in relation to housing arrangements of one sort or another. And so, I guess that's all what I've got to say about that. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Okay, the question is, if you look at different occupations, do you see this gradient effect? Yeah, and the answer is yes. I mean, it's an interesting thing, the way this gradient works is that you can replicate it in a very similar way if you divide the population up by, like I said, you know, quintiles of income or by those who have graduated from university, those who have had some university, those with high school graduation, those less. Or if you go, say, from those occupations which are considered to be the most prestigious to those that are considered to be the least prestigious. And you get the same kind of patterns. Now within that, you get, within the occupational one, you get some special characteristics. Like one occupation that's turned out to consistently be a low life expectancy occupation is bus driver. And that's raised a number of questions. And I mean, it seems that largely what it comes down to is an issue of demand and control. Whether the level of the ability to, in a sense, control the demands that are placed upon you in the working context seem to be particularly perverse in that occupation compared to others. And despite the fact that we have an impression in society that occupations that involve a lot of social responsibility are the ones that are most stressful, that isn't really the way it works. The fact is that the occupations that turn out to be the most stressful, particularly in terms of physiologic response, are the ones which are the thankless ones, the ones that are low status and prestige, high demand, and really all that happens is that you get slapped around if you don't do the job, and you don't get slapped around if you do the job, but there are really no rewards. So what can be said for bus drivers can also be said quite often for waitresses as well. Yes, Peter. Okay. The basic idea, okay, sorry, he said, could I flesh out the theories being pursued by the neuroimmunologists, for example? Okay, the basic theory is this, that during the second trimester of pregnancy, you start sprouting brain cells in the developing fetus at the rate of tens of millions per week, such that by the time you are born, you have all of the brain cells you're ever going to have. And they're all connected together in a big mass. And then what happens is, under the weight of experience, and the experience can be visual, auditory, tactile, emotional, etc. Smell, yes, thank you. Smell. Your brain sculpts itself under the weight of experience. In other words, some of the connections between the cells in the brain are reinforced and some of them die away. And it is the reinforced connections inside the brain that are the basis for perception, coping, and competence. So if what you do is subject developing humans from the age of 0 to, say, 5 to a wide range of qualities of environment in terms of access to adults and other children, to the sound of the human voice, to a variety of visual stimuli, to emotional warmth, to nutrition for that matter, you are going to get a wide range in the level and complexity of neural connections in the brain, such that by say age 5 or 6, there will be in fact structural differences between those who have been well nurtured and those who have not. And there is quite a body of evidence to suggest that such a thing goes on. Now further, it turns out that there are profound connections between the brain and a variety of host defense mechanisms in the body. The immune system, the hormone systems that relate to stress responses, the systems that have got to do with managing blood vessel walls, the systems that have got to do with blood clotting and so forth. And so the hypothesis is that systematic differences in the development of the brain will lead to systematic differences in the way in which host defense mechanisms will respond to environmental stimuli. And that furthermore, those who have been well-nurtured, on average, will be more competent and able to cope more. So a given stimuli will, on average, be less stressful because it will be more recognizable and controllable. So that there will be, if you'd like, over the lifetime, a kind of a intimate dialectic of the individual and his or her capabilities and the qualities of the environments and the perception of the stressfulness of those environments. And that over time, those who have had less good nurturing and therefore, and once again, we're speaking of a grant hypothesis here, you know, less good host defense characteristics will therefore, on average, age faster. And so that what would happen to somebody who was better nurtured, let's say at age 75, will tend on average to happen to somebody else at an earlier age. Now, I don't have time to go through all the bits and pieces that make that an alluring hypothesis, except to say that there are bits and pieces out there that make it worth pursuing. Okay, that's a very good question. I just want to amend it slightly. Okay? What happened was, if you look at Canada, the life expectancy gap was about 2 years back at 1921. It increased to 7 years by 1978, and it's now dropped to 5.6 years. So it's starting to shrink again. Oops, the mic died on me. Hello? I've obviously expired. Here. This one's still going. Okay. Well, it's a very, very interesting point, because what you have to ask is, what happened during the middle of the 20th century to cause, first of all, the gap to open, and then the gap to start to close again? And this is my hypothesis, and once again, this is coming from out in left field. If you go back to, let's say, the late part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, you still have the majority of people living in rural circumstances on farms, et cetera, et cetera. And so what you had there was a form of similarity between the roles that men and women played in their day-to-day lives. They lived close together and they worked close together. And then, during the 20th century, what tended to happen was that men tended to go out to a variety of heavy industrial occupations, which tended to be fairly nasty sorts of places, and women, by and large, stayed within the domestic environment and took care of things there. They did not go down the mines. They did not do those sorts of things. Now, I think two kinds of things happen with that. First off, the kind of conditions that people were placed under, that men were placed under in relation to those things, were such that the idea was that you were supposed to make your living now and, in a sense, the devil take the hindmost. Now, if you go to a country like Romania today, working conditions there are probably a lot the way they were in the 20s and 30s and 40s in Canada, and that's what you see there, in fact. You see a lot of people doing jobs that clearly are having a negative impact on their health over time, but there's nothing really they can do about it. You either do it or you starve, right? So not only do you get that, but you also get within that, presumably, an awful lot of what would be considered uncontrollable demands. And finally, what you get in that situation is an almost pathological inability to make any personal investments in health status. In other words, it's very, very difficult to consider not smoking a lot and not drinking a lot if, in fact, you're in the process of, you know, filling your lungs up with silica or something like that. So during the middle of the 20th century, then, a very large difference started to emerge between men and women in terms of where they went to work and those kind of conditions under which they worked. And differences in health habits and behaviors built up under that as well. Meanwhile, on the other side, the job that women were given was, in fact, a social role, a role from which there really isn't retirement in the same way in which the role that men were given on average there was. In other words, if you're doing backbreaking labor, as soon as you become
too old and sick to do it, you were then useless, right? And the ethos during much of the middle part of the century was basically to work yourself to death, effectively. Whereas the job of being the social center of a household was a job that can effectively last for an indefinite period of time. So there was a difference there. And then what started to happen in the mid to late 70s is the social roles started to become more similar again. And the differences between what men and women are doing is increasingly declining with increased women's labor force participation, et cetera, et cetera. And so with that, what we're starting to see is some sort of a gradual coming together. Now, my guess is it'll never come all the way together. There's no question that if all other things are equal, women will live longer than men. There are a number of examples where you can show that women basically have, in the long run, stronger constitutions than men do over time. But the question is, what is the base level of the life expectancy gap that you would imagine in a long-lived society? And we do know, for instance, that the gap can be as small as 3 or 4 years, as it is, for instance, within the Jewish population. And then on the other hand, it's as high as 9 or 10 years in some places, such as in Russia. So presumably then, what we're going to see is that this difference of about 5.5 years will continue to shrink till about under 4 years, and then it'll probably stop at that point under the weight of basic biological differences. That's the best I can do. Yes?
Is socialized medicine a factor influencing the health of societies, comparing like former Soviet Union and the United States?
That's a very good question. The question is socialized medicine a factor influencing the health status of societies like Canada compared to the United States or something? That's an excellent question. The answer ought to be well known and straightforward, and in fact it's not. You have to understand that although many of the healthcare services that are delivered to Canadians are effective in and of themselves, that there have never been systematic attempts to measure the impact of healthcare services on the health of the population. I mean, it seems absurd to say that, but it's in fact true. So what we do know is that, for instance, when there has been opting out of the Medicare system, for instance, the way it was going in Ontario in the early 1980s, where nearly 20% of physicians had opted out of the system for a period of time there, you did start to see situations where poorer people were, in fact, avoiding some forms of medically necessary care, which on the basis of clinical trials, one would suggest, ought to have created health problems for them, right? So from a deductive standpoint, it would seem to be true that in a direct sense, universal access to healthcare, in other words, the removal of fiscal barriers to healthcare, ought to have a positive impact on health status overall. The other side of this is that when we ask, okay, why is the socioeconomic gradient in health status steeper in the United States than it is in Canada? Part of that must be explained in some way or another by access to effective healthcare services in Canada compared to the States, where, as we know, a very large fraction of the population doesn't have automatic access, has profound financial barriers. The other element, though, and it may be a more important element, has got to do with the fact that when you compare Canadians versus Americans' perception, in a sense, of their level of security, Canadians are much more secure because that is one thing they don't have to worry about, the idea of becoming destitute because they are sick. And so it is one profound element of life control that Canadians have that Americans don't have. And it may be that the element of control in terms of that is as important, if not more important, than the effectiveness of the specific services or the access to effective services.
One last question.
Yes.
If there is one last question.
There's one over there.
Yeah. Okay. The first part of the question was to comment on control as a determinant of health.
Within gender and race and
class. Oh, okay. Okay. Within gender. Let me give you gender, okay? Okay. The question I'm going to answer is to comment on the role of control and in relation to gender as a determinant of health. We do have actually some pretty clear evidence among the adult population how this works. And among men, the way it seems to work is that having a high level of control at work is strongly associated with better health status and is strongly predictive of low mortality and morbidity in the future. In other words, if you ask, 10,000 men right now what their level of control is at work, those who have high level of control will on average be healthier over the next, 10 or 20 years than those who have low level of control. For women, it tends to work a little different. For women, what seems to matter is control when you talk about the conjunction of work life and home life. In other words, control at work on its own doesn't seem to matter so much as whether or not, when you take the whole picture of responsibilities, whether or not the mixture of demands between work and home is controllable. Right? And that's what seems to matter more than anything. So that there is a gender difference so far as that goes. I can't comment on it in terms of race. I really haven't looked at that very closely. Oh, in terms of class, yeah. No, you do see a clear monotonic gradient in terms of level of control as you go down the income spectrum or down the occupational or educational spectrum. There's no question about that.
Wonderful question, period. And I would now like to call on Dr. John Cairns, the Dean of Medicine, to thank our speaker.
Thank you, Cheryl. It certainly gives me great pleasure to be able to thank Dr. Hertzman this evening. I'm actually very proud of him. When I was a assistant professor at McMaster, Clyde was a medical student there, and I remember him manifesting some of the traits he exhibited this evening. It's a very healthy disrespect for convention, passionately held views, and very strong scholarship, and I think we saw those emerge this evening. Clyde went on eventually to do training in community medicine and in epidemiology at McMaster, and then eventually came to UBC in 1985. And I guess about the time he came here, or very shortly after, became one of the fellows of the Canadian Institute of Advanced Research. This is an outstanding virtual institute of some of Canada's strongest scholars in fields as diverse as physics, sociology, medicine, social determinants of health, as is Clyde's area. And he brought the strength of that group to UBC, and we actually have a number of individuals who are part of that research institute here at University of British Columbia. Clyde is in the Faculty of Medicine here in the Department of Healthcare and Epidemiology, and again, from another perspective, I have the opportunity to be very proud of him. The talk this evening, I think, had many features of an excellent talk. It was based on very sound scholarship, which we expect of any speaker here. The topic was very broad and of general interest and of great social importance. He didn't answer all the questions. He answered many questions, but I think particularly important, he's left us with questions and left us with challenges. The issues he's raising are of key importance to any society as we contemplate the significance of what he's been saying. And I think we leave this evening contemplating those. We don't feel that all the answers have been given. We're left thinking and looking forward to future challenges. Clyde, I think it was a wonderful speech this evening. I think the audience testifies to the interest that preceded your talk, and all the questions and enthusiasm reflect what a success it was. So thank you very much for a wonderful evening.
As well.